that stimulate our motivation. And take a minute to really rejoice that we have this opportunity, not only because we have a human body and health and food and other necessities to practice, but also because we have an inner interest and spiritual inquiry that wants to understand life. And then let's think of how best to use our life. If the best use is struggling for pleasure, chasing after whatever looks good and pushing away whatever we don't like, is that going to bring us the kind of happiness we want? Or is the happiness we want going to come through internal transformation, through freeing our mind from ignorance, attachment, and anger, through developing love, compassion, and wisdom? And so let's choose the kind of happiness that comes through the internal development, because it's much more reliable, much more in tune with reality. And let's seek that happiness from internal development, not just for ourselves, but for all living beings, because all living beings like us want to be happy and don't want to suffer. They've all been kind to us. And so let's extend our motivation so that we want to develop our spiritual potential to the highest, in other words, to become fully enlightened Buddhas, so that we can really be of the greatest benefit to all living beings. And so take a moment and develop that bodhicitta motivation. Okay. So, since last week, did you figure out if you are you or I? Or if I am you or I? Did you figure out? Did you play with it at all during the week? And see? No? So, the question came up last week about, I experience the sensations that come from this body, and I experience the moods that exist in this mind, and so I am I, because it's this body and this mind. Okay? And I think that we feel that way so strongly because of our innate self-grasping. You know, we identify very strongly with our aggregates, you know, and very strong attachment to this body, so that whatever this body experiences, we say, I'm experiencing this. So there's a big I that is seen as the owner of this body, my body, because I experience the sensations from it. So there's a lot of identification with the body, a lot of grasping at this body as our possession, and similarly with our mind, whatever our moods are, you know, I feel happy, I feel sad, I feel angry, I feel depressed, I feel joyous. All these moods are seen as mine, you know, some kind of inherent connection between the moods and me, and there's this real me that's the owner of the moods. Sometimes we even get it a little confused and we think we are the moods or we are the sensations. You know, I'm such an angry person, I am my anger. You know, we have a very confused relationship between the aggregates and the self because we're grasping at the inherent existence of both of them. And so when we have that strong grasping, then, you know, yes, I am here and you are there, and the I is real because I feel the result, this body and this mind, and I'm not feeling, you know, what's happening with your body and your mind because you're out there, external, completely distinct from me, and, you know, therefore not nearly as important. Yeah. But it's interesting when we feel that way strongly, oh, my body, my mind, I feel the sensations, to ask ourselves, well, who exactly is feeling the sensations of this body and mind? Who's experiencing it? You know, because when we say it, we have this strong feeling of a strong, big, fat I there. Okay? But if we stop and say, who's experiencing this? Or whose body is this? Whose mind is this? Who's experiencing the moods? Who's experiencing the hunger or the aching knees? You know, we start to question that a little bit. You know, the things appear a bit differently to us. Even talking about it, do you get some different sensation? Yeah, just questioning this a little bit. And we begin to see that we don't have to grasp at this inherently existent me there that is the experiencer, an inherently existent me experiencing the feelings of an inherently existent body and the moods of an inherently existent mind. Okay? But we can begin to say that we just say, I experience it, because there's simply a merely labeled I. There's not a big I in there. And then we can begin to see that the sensations in our body, the moods in our mind, are just sensations. They're just moods. They're not me. And they don't have to be objects that are big, you know, belong to an inherently existent me. Okay? So if you feel sensations, you know, okay, there's hot and there's cold. And you can just feel them. But that's quite different than saying, I feel hot and I'm miserable and I want it to go away and I feel cold and this is rotten and this is unfair. Okay? Do you see the difference in those? Yeah? And so when we just say, oh, there's heat and there's cold, you know, and there's not this big I, then it becomes more possible to see that, yes, others experience heat and cold, and there's nothing particularly me about the heat and cold. Okay, there's nothing particularly me that I need to hold on to that is this heat and cold. Or if I'm feeling happiness or sadness, there's nothing particularly me that's identified with this happiness and sadness. There's just happiness, there's just sadness, but there's not some inherently existent person experiencing happiness or experiencing sadness. Okay? So if we let go of that feeling of some inherently existent person there, then the boundaries of I and you don't become so rigid. Yeah? There's just kind of moods. Okay, nothing special about my moods. Yeah, you have moods, nothing special about those moods that are you, you know. From your side, you know, we can identify those are, you know, Harry's moods, and my side, they're children's moods. But the children and the Harry are not real substantial people there who are experiencing those things. Okay? So when we think like this, then the boundary between self and others doesn't seem quite so strong, because we're not grasping so strongly to what our body and mind are experiencing. And then that makes it easier to say, okay, on the basis of this body and mind, we say I. On the basis, you know, somebody else's body and mind, there's also I. On the basis of this person over here, on the basis of their body and mind, there's also I, you know? There's all these different I's, and it's just depending upon which perspective you're looking at it from, whether it's my I or somebody else's I or whatever. Are you getting what I mean? Yeah? A little bit here? Mm. Yeah? It's hard because we are so used to just this incredible attachment to our own body and mind and feeling so identified with what goes on with this body and mind. I mean, it's just such a real experience for us. And then if you think, you know, if we get in touch with how everything about our body and mind seems so real, we're so buffeted around by the feelings in the body and the mind, then what happens at the time of death when we separate from this body? What happens then?
Disturbed mind.
Hmm?
Disturbed mind.
Yeah, pretty disturbed mind, isn't it? Because we're so used to feeling the sensation of I in relationship to this body. But that's a complete misconception. Because if the I and the body had this inherent relationship like this, then it wouldn't be possible to separate from this body. Okay? But at some point, this body just disintegrates. Yes, bye-bye, body. You know, ciao. Yeah. And it's not like there's some inherently existent self that's just trotting along after the body disintegrates, you know, because the self is merely labeled in dependence upon the body and mind being together. Okay, so you can't, when the body disappears, it's not like you have some, you know, little thing out there that's me that's rising above the body and still has this feeling of me-ness. You know how sometimes people describe out-of-body experiences? Oh yes, I just floated outside my body and I was looking down. Well, there's still that feeling of an inherently existent I there, isn't it, you know? Except now that I is equal to the mind. But then also, somehow it's, you know, located above the body. But the mind is formless. Mm-hmm. And how's it going to feel when this mind starts to change? Because right now we have the human aggregates of mind. What happens, you know, these human aggregates of this particular rebirth, they cease at the time of death, and we get new aggregates in the next life. Not only the body changes, but, you know, if you're born as a deva, then you get the mental aggregates of the deva, and maybe you're born as a human being again, you get other human aggregates, but they're not exactly the same human aggregates, not the exact same aggregates of feeling and discrimination, volitional formations and consciousnesses we have now. Because they're the next birth's aggregates, not this birth's aggregates. Yeah? So when we think like that, well, where's this big fat self that is here that we feel is really me in conjunction to the body and mind, you know, that has to be cherished and identified as me? And therefore, everything else is you and different and not as important. Okay? So, you know, they say that the second way of developing bodhicitta, the Shantideva's method of equalizing and exchanging self for others, they say that this is the way that sharp faculty disciples develop bodhicitta. And the seven-point cause-and-effect instruction is the way that modest faculty disciples develop bodhicitta. And you can see why, can't you? Yeah? Because when you start to do this meditation on equalizing and exchanging self and others, automatically in there, you're beginning to get into emptiness, aren't you? And you're beginning to question exactly what this I is and how it relates to me and you and identification with my body and mind and, you know, all these kinds of things. Whereas with the seven-point instruction, you're not necessarily getting into any kind of reflection on emptiness when you do that method of cultivating bodhicitta. Okay? So that's why this way is said to be for sharp faculty people, which of course we all want to be. Whether we are or not, we want to think of ourselves as that way. Anyway. Okay, so the first step in equalizing, exchanging self and others was this equalizing thing, which, remember, isn't just equalizing friend, enemy, and stranger, it's also equalizing self and others. So just as I want happiness, other people do too, exactly with the same intensity. There's no difference. Just as I want to be free of suffering, so do other people too. No difference. And furthermore, what I say is I and what I say is you, it's just a matter of perspective. Yeah? It just can change and alter very quickly, like this side of the valley and that side of the valley. Depends, you know. If we walk on the other side, then this side becomes that side and that side becomes this side. Doesn't it? Okay? So therefore there's no reason to be attached to this side or that side thinking that they're inherently existent. And similarly, no reason to be, you know, sunk in this thing of a real me and a real you, and therefore I have to look out for me and forget you. Okay? So that equalizing is the first step. Then the second step in equalizing self and others is to see the disadvantages of the self-centered mind. Okay, so this topic can go on and on for three countless great eons, you know, talking about the disadvantages of the self-centered mind. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about translation here, because sometimes people translate that the Tibetan term as self-cherishing mind. And that becomes confusing for people, because people say, well, shouldn't I cherish myself? If I don't cherish myself, then I must hate myself. So, you know, does Buddhism want me to hate myself? Is that the antidote to self-cherishing? So do you see how the translation of self-cherishing can become confusing for us? And then since we already have so much self-hatred, it becomes even more over the top. Okay. So I talked to one of my friends one time, and this has to deal with our kind of particular variety as Westerners of psychological issues that, you know, people in other cultures don't have in the same exact way, you know, because the conditioning has been different. But she went to one Tibetan Lama and said, you know, I've been meditating on the disadvantages of self-cherishing, and I just hate myself as a result of it, because I see I'm so selfish and I just take care of myself all the time, and I feel so guilty about it, and I'm so selfish and rotten, and I hate myself for it. Is this the right way to meditate on the disadvantages of self-cherishing? And the Lama, it was done through a translator, and the Lama said yes. And she went home and went, oh my goodness, do I want to practice Buddhism? You know, because mamma mia, this self-hatred is really intense. And is this, you know, how is this that I'm supposed to feel this is the way of meditating on the disadvantages of self-cherishing? And it wasn't until later, you know, that she talked to some other people and she began to realize that the way the Lama was hearing it, also through the translator, he was hearing a very different meaning than what she was expressing. Because what he was hearing was, oh, you're seeing the self-centeredness as your enemy. And what she was saying is, I see myself as my enemy, and therefore hate myself and want to destroy myself. Okay? And so he was hearing it very different from what she was saying. Yeah. So she and I talked about it, and I said, no, you know, hating yourself is not the result you're supposed to get from this meditation. Yeah. And what's to hate about the self? The self is a merely labeled thing. No reason to hate it. Okay. But the self-centeredness, yeah, is our enemy. Because it makes us suffer. Okay. And then to see that you can still care about yourself without being self-centered. Okay. And this is what's tricky about if we translate it as self-cherishing, because you're supposed to get rid of self-cherishing, so how do you cherish yourself? Yeah. So the whole thing is, how do we care for ourselves or cherish ourselves or whatever in a healthy way, and how do we see that the self-centered mind or self-preoccupied mind or selfish mind, how do we see that that is our enemy and it's not who we are? Okay, so those are two very, very important aspects of this meditation that we can easily get confused about and come up with very much the wrong ideas. Okay, so when we're talking about self-centered, we're talking about a mind. It's not who we are. It's one attitude. It's one mental state that cherishes, or that, put it this way, it centers everything around the self so that I become the most important thing in the universe. That's what the self-centered mind is. And so it becomes self-preoccupied because we're always thinking about the self and what's good for me and what makes my life easier and how can I succeed and how can I get what I want and how can I feel good about myself, and everything always about me, okay? And it's that self-centered mind, okay? So it considers me the most important thing in the universe, and it is an obsessive mind about me because it views everything that happens in relationship to the self. Okay? There's no space in that mind to see the bigger picture because everything is self-referenced. Yeah? And it's self-referenced in a very unhealthy way. Yeah? Because the self-centered mind has this idea of, I better take care of myself because if I don't take care of myself, nobody else will. And taking care of myself means that I get everything that's going to make me happy and push away everything that's going to make me miserable. Okay, that's how that mind thinks. Okay? That mind is not who we are. We are not union oneness with that mind. It's just a mental state that comes up from time to time. It comes up a lot from time to time, you know, but it's not who we are. And the thing is then to, you know, separate out the self, the conventionally existent self, from that inherently, that feeling of self-centeredness, and then ask, it does that mind of self-centeredness, is it really working for my benefit? You know, what is the effect of me following that mind of self-centeredness? What is the effect on me? What is the effect on others? On my spiritual practice? Because this is a kind of investigation that we never do in our ordinary life, do we? Yeah. Do we ever stop to think about, you know, questioning what our mind, the ideas that pop into our mind? Do we ever question what the self-centered mind says and ask ourselves if it's helping us and if it's realistic? We never do. You know, we just follow it. Self-centered mind says, tell that person out, and we say, aye, aye, sir. And self-centered mind says, get that for yourself before somebody else does. And we go, you're right. Yeah? Okay. So this meditation involves separating the conventional eye from the self-centered mind, and then looking at what the effects of the self-centered mind are. Okay? And looking at how following that self-centered mind affects us. Okay? If I'm following my self-centered mind, am I going to be happier? Yeah. Just ask ourselves this. Our initial response might be yes, because I'll get the piece of chocolate cake. You know, survival of the fittest. I'm going to get it before somebody else gets it. That'll make me happier. Yeah, it's our Darwinian mind that we kind of bring into all spheres of our life. But then, just in social situations, what happens if we're always looking out for ourselves and ignoring others? Yeah. what happens if I'm the first one to go through the food line and I just take however much food I want without realizing there's a number of people following behind me? What's going to happen? Are you guys going to be happy? No, no way. Okay. And you're going to complain about me. Hey, just because you go through the food line first and you're taking all the good stuff and there's nothing left for us. Okay. So then what happened to me is I'm stuck living with a bunch of people who are unhappy with me because I was looking out for myself and getting everything I wanted. Okay. Now, when I have to live with a bunch of people that are unhappy with me, am I happy? No. Okay. If I care about the people who I live with and I want them to be happy and they're happy and they're content, then I live with a group of people who are happy and content. Am I like more likely to be happy then? Yes. So this is why His Holiness says, if you want to be selfish and look out for your own happiness, then take care of others. Okay? Because, you know, we can see very, very clearly that when we take care of the other sentient beings with whom we have relationship with, then we live in a much happier environment than when we're competing with them, trying to conquer them, trying to get more for ourselves, trying to be better than they are, trying to make ourselves shine and them, you know, go in the mud. Okay? And we begin to see, really, that all this competition and putting others down, it doesn't work as a method for our own happiness. And it doesn't work as a method for others' happiness. Because our happiness is related to other people's happiness. It's not that we can just work and be happy on our own without caring about others. Because we live in an interdependent world. Okay? So it's not my happiness or your happiness. It's our happiness. Because if you're miserable, then I live with miserable people and I'm unhappy. If you're happy, I live with happy people and I'm happy. Okay? So this whole mind that we have that says, I better take it from me before somebody else gets it, that mind actually steals away our happiness. Yeah? What do you think? What do you think? And so this meditation, I think, is really effective, you know, in looking back on our life. Yeah. And we've all had problems in our life, right? Tons of them. Yeah. None of us, I don't care how old we are, we've all had tons of problems. Pick out some of the most significant difficulties that you've had in your life and ask yourself how the self-centered mind was related to those difficulties. Okay? You know, like maybe you know you have a relationship with somebody, you have a very good friend or what, some kind of relationship or whatever, or even your parents, you know, our parents, our friends, our teachers, yeah. And when there's been obstacles in those relationships and there's been unhappy feelings and there's been conflict between us and them, do a little bit of investigation and ask, how has my self-centered attitude contributed to my having conflicts with these people? Because usually when we have conflicts, it's all their fault. And, you know, my teenage years, you know, it's my parents' fault. Yeah, it's the government's fault. It's my teacher's fault. And then somehow meeting the Dharma, then looking and thinking, okay, when I didn't get along with my parents, how much of this was my self-centeredness acting in here too? Was I really caring for my parents, or was I just caring about me? You know, and thinking, well, my parents had me, so, and I didn't ask to be had, and their job is to be parents, which means to give me everything I want. you know, and to be everything I want them to be. Yeah, that's their job description. They're supposed to be perfect and be everything I want them to be. And when they aren't, then, you know, I blame them. Well, how much? And of course, you know, when I hold that attitude, then I'm not going to get along with my parents or my friends or whoever it is. Okay? Now, when I hold that attitude, isn't that attitude a bit self-centered? What do you think? You should be who I want you to be. Is that self-centered? I think so. Yeah? So whoever I look at when my mind is thinking, you should be who I want you to be. Yeah. And you're not who I want you to be. And that's your fault. Therefore, you're making me unhappy. To really look and, you know, where's that whole perspective coming from? That perspective is coming from my self-centered attitude. Do I have any right to tell somebody who they should be? Or to tell them that they should be who I think they should be? Hey, this is a free world. You know, people are going to be who they want to be anyway. I don't have any right to say you need to be what I want you to be. So what's causing the conflict and the misery? It's me holding on and demanding this, you know, instead of accepting the other person as they are. I have my job description for them. Okay? Whether it's my parents, you know, my friends, whoever it is. Are you getting what I mean? Yeah? So then when we start looking, we're like, oh boy, you know, this self-centered mind is causing me problems. And then how do I act when I have this self-centered mind? What's my speech like? Okay, or put it a different way, okay, because we've already meditated on karma, right? You know, we've gone through the 10 non-virtues. So take any of the 10 non-virtues. Okay, take lying. Okay, when I've lied, has it been for the benefit of the self-centered thought or the benefit of all sentient beings? Who do I lie to benefit? Whenever I lie, who am I looking out for? Myself, aren't I? Yeah. Whenever I use my speech to create disharmony, what mind is propelling me to use my speech to create disharmony? Is it love? Is it compassion? Or is it self-centeredness? Yeah? So it's very interesting. Take out the times. You know, when we did all the purification meditating on karma, we had different situations in our life that we remembered that we wanted to purify. Take those situations out again. And look at, you know, well, what were my motivations? You know, when I spoke harshly to somebody, what was my motivation? That was anger. It was attachment. Well, who am I considering most important when I have anger or attachment or resentment or belligerence? Who's the most important one in my mind when I have those kind of mental states? Me. Isn't it? Yeah? When I'm talking idly and trying to make myself look big and be a big shot, who am I looking out for? Myself. Okay? Then you look at killing and stealing and unwise sexual conduct. Okay? All of that's because of self-centeredness, isn't it? I want or I don't want. So we can look, you know, in any of the 10 destructive actions, what's laid behind them? Self-centeredness. What's the results of the 10 negative actions? Lower rebirth for ourselves. So does self-centeredness help make us happy? No. What does self-centeredness do? It makes us do actions that bring us a lower rebirth, which is misery. It makes us do actions like, you know, the 10 destructive actions that leave us feeling guilty and bad about ourselves. Yeah. They make us do those actions that destroy our relationships with other people and that make us unhappy. So is this self-centered attitude our friend? Is it looking out for our welfare? Should we follow it? Yeah? when we really look this way, we see, you know, this self-centered attitude is a big liar. You know? And it's, you know, we've just been deceived by it for so long. But when we really look at our own experience and see, then it's like, huh, what am I following this mind for? Yeah. When the alarm clock rings in the morning, okay, and we've had enough sleep, so I'm not talking about a time when you're sleep deprived, you've had enough sleep, and you go, I don't want to get up, I want to sleep through morning meditation. Yeah? Why do I have to get up and go to morning meditation? So you press off the alarm clock, you put the pillow over your head, you go back to sleep, okay? Then, what's the results of doing that? Okay, when you wake up, do you feel more refreshed? No, because you've already slept enough when the alarm clock rang. Okay, so you don't feel more refreshed. Then, you miss morning meditation, so you crawl into the dining room hoping nobody noticed that you missed morning meditation. Do you feel relaxed and happy? And no. Then there was the opportunity to do something virtuous, even if you were half asleep doing it virtuously, you know, doing 35 Buddhas or something. Then you missed that opportunity. Okay? So is that self-centered mind making you happy? No. No, it's not. Yeah? And so, you know, this morning when we were talking and yeah, you were saying about when you wake up in the morning and then you feel a little bit tired and then you say, oh, today's just going to be a horrible day. I feel so tired and I'm in such a bad mood. And then you just, that's your motivation for the day. You know, I woke up and I'm tired, so this whole day is shot and I'm going to be in a bad mood and just forget it. When you think like that, is that self-centered thought? It sure is, isn't it? And then we were talking at breakfast how that way of thinking is completely ridiculous. You know, because you were saying whatever made you feel tired is gone by 8 o'clock and you feel fine. So why set your motivation to be miserable all day because you didn't get enough sleep when the symptoms are going to be gone in an hour? So what is it that keeps us trapped in that? That's the self-centered thought, isn't it? Okay? So we begin to see the self-centeredness is our real enemy. Yeah? And it really impedes on our happiness. Now, sometimes we hear this teaching and then we go, okay, from now on, I can't do anything that's self-centered. And then any time any thought comes in our mind like, you know, I'm hungry, I want to eat, then we say, oh, that's self-centeredness. No, you can't eat, you know. Or the mind thinks, oh, I want to go to Dharma teachings. And you think, oh, that's self-centeredness because I said I want to go to Dharma teachings. That's it. Just unhappy. That's just, you know, attachment and self-centered mind. So I shouldn't go to Dharma teachings because that's being self-centered. We go on all these extreme ways of misunderstanding the teachings, thinking that every time we say the word I, that we're being self-centered. That's not accurate. Don't think like that. Okay? Every time we say the word I, it does not mean we're being self-centered. You know, when you say I'm hungry, the conventional I is hungry. Yeah? So the conventional I needs to eat, and you feed it so you keep your body healthy, so you can practice the Dharma. Okay? Now, what does become self-centered was, I'm hungry. Okay, well, when we say I'm hungry, that's not self-centered. When we say I'm hungry and I want to eat, you know, what do I want to eat? I want to eat chocolate cake and I want to eat baked tofu and I want to have fresh peas and fresh salad, and I want to have this and that and the other thing, and this is what I feel like eating, so this is definitely what we should have for the meal. Okay, that's becoming self-centered. Okay? Because we're getting all, you know, revolved in I want, I should have. Okay. And then of course we go in the kitchen and we tell the cook, don't cook that, cook this and put this in it, put that in it and get out of here, I'll cook because I want to make it for me and I won't make enough for you, and you know, we get all tangled up. Okay, that's self-centered. But just saying, I'm hungry and I want to eat, that's fine. Okay, you getting what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know? Or you say, I want to, you know, I like practicing Dharma. I want to go and meditate. That's not self-centered. That's something that's beneficial for you to do. I want to go listen to teachings. That's not self-centered. Okay? I want to take medicine because I'm sick. That's not self-centered. Yeah? If you start thinking, I want this medicine, nobody else can have it, and I want the best medicine, and all the doctors should stop what they're doing to take care of me, that's self-centered. But saying, I need some medicine to get well, nothing wrong with that. Okay? So don't think that every time you say the word I, you're being self-centered. Mm-hmm. And don't think that the antidote to self-centeredness is to beat up on yourself and hate yourself. Repeat for whoever is listening out there. Okay, the antidote to self-centeredness is not to beat up on yourself and get down on yourself. Because beating up on ourselves, you know, and going through our litany of I'm so worthless because I'm self-centered. I'm such an unqualified Buddhist because I'm self-centered. How can I even call myself a practitioner because I'm self-centered? I'm not worth anything. Okay? That is a self-centered way of thinking. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? When we get in our whole self-deprecation trip, that's just another form of self-centeredness. Because it's just making a big deal out of me again. You know, and on our horizons, we're like that horse with these blinders on, you know. And except instead of saying, I'm the most important because I need to have this and this, it's I'm the most important because I'm the worst one. But it's still all self-focused. So don't think that beating up on yourself and tearing yourself down and criticizing yourself for being self-centered is the antidote to being self-centered. Okay? Because it's not. And it's also confusing the self with the self-centered attitude. Okay? Well, if we criticize the self-centered attitude, that's okay. But if we confuse the self with the self-centered attitude and then criticize, that's when we get really tangled up. So we have to really separate out and say, okay, that's my self-centered attitude. You know, there it is. And it's been running the show. And that thing's the thing to blame. But without blaming the conventional self. Getting what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah? This is really, really important. Yeah? Because if you confuse these two, you just get so tangled up. And then just get into this whole self-loathing thing, which was like my friend, you know, what happened to her. Okay? So don't do that. But rather, you know, if we just have in our mind, okay, the self-centered mind or self-obsessed mind, it's not who I am. And I'm going to look at my life history and watch when this self-centered mind has been active and what it's made me do and how it's distorted my vision and how it's affected my relationship and how it's affected my spiritual wishes and my spiritual desires. You know, because self-centeredness also gets in the way of our spiritual practice, doesn't it? Yeah. And then examining that and then really see, oh, the self-centered mind, it is a thief and it's a liar and it deceives me. and it is not me, and I'm going to look at it as the enemy. Okay. Then when the self-centered thought arises, we point our finger at it and we say, you're making me unhappy, and I'm not going to follow you anymore, because last time I did, you just got me into this big mess. So now I'm smarter. I'm not going to do the same thing of listening to your crooked, rotten advice, self-centered mind. Okay? So you talk to the self-centered mind as if you're talking to, you know, some other person. Because remember, you're not criticizing yourself. So if you can do that, then it can be really, really effective. And there's even one way where when somebody criticizes you, okay? Somebody criticizes you. And then you think, none of us like criticism, do we? You know, I don't know about you, it's one of my most unfavorite things. You want to make me unhappy? Criticize me. Okay? So, I know I just gave away my secret. So I get very unhappy when I'm criticized. Then, to look and see that the self-centered mind, you think, when somebody criticizes, okay, I'm getting criticized because this is a result of my own past karma. So I've criticized other people in the past. Right? Wrong. Right. Lots of people. Yeah. Why am I so surprised when somebody criticizes me? I've criticized lots of people. Okay? In fact, the amount of criticism I hear is nothing compared to the amount of criticism I've given. So, under what state of mind did I give criticism? What motivated me to criticize other people that created this karma for me to be criticized? My self-centered attitude. So the self-centered attitude is the real thing to blame when I'm unhappy because I'm getting criticized. Because it's my self-centered attitude that made me criticize others, that put that karmic imprint in my mind, that's making me unhappy right now. So, if the self-centered attitude is the root of it, then when I get criticized, I should actually give that criticism to the self-centered attitude. And it should be the one that experiences pain, not me. Because the self-centered mind was the one that's the cause. Okay. So then, somebody's sitting there saying, making faces, screaming and yelling, and you think in your mind, you have self-centered attitude sitting beside you, and you think, they're just telling off my self-centered mind. Well, my self-centered mind is my enemy. Okay? When my enemy gets told off, I'm happy, right? So criticize more. Yeah? Go ahead, criticize all you want to, because I'm giving all that unhappiness to the self-centered mind. It can have it. Okay, getting what I mean? Okay. Well, I remember hearing this teaching. Lama Zopa taught this when I was kind of a baby beginner, and I thought, what kind of meditation is that? I didn't kind of get it, and then. Some years later, I was on pilgrimage in Tibet. Some of you have heard me tell this story, but I was on pilgrimage to Tibet. We were going to Lama Lhotso, which is it's the famous lake where when they want to find the new Dalai Lama, they go and do puja, the high lamas, and they look in and they see different letters and everything. So we're on pilgrimage to this very holy lake, and we're on horseback. There were maybe 5 of us on horseback, so I'm going, maybe 6 of us. Anyway, we're going along. So my friend is on one horse, and he was having problems with his horse. You know, like his horse would stop in the middle of the stream and wouldn't keep going and would just stop there. So, and he was getting in a really bad mood because of it. So I thought, okay, I'll just offer to switch horses with him because I had a very sweet horse, who was really nice. So I said to my friend, you know, if you want to, we can switch horses. Well, I don't know what happened, but he got furious with me. And he just turned and he just, you know, he just told me off really big time. And he was bringing up all these things from the past because we had known each other a number of years. So all these things that I had done here and all these things that he had heard, you know, that I had done to other people. So not even stuff I had done to him, but things that he had heard other people criticize me for. And he's throwing all this stuff at me, you know. And I'm kind of going, whoa, where did this come from? And then, I don't know why, I think this is the blessing of doing pilgrimage, but the thought entered my mind of, I'm going to give all this criticism to the self-centered mind. Because it's my self-centered mind that's really the source of all of this. So I sat there while he's sitting there just saying these incredible things, and I'm thinking it's all, he's attacking my self-centered mind. He's criticizing my self-centered mind. He's blaming my self-centered mind. He's not blaming me. He's blaming my self-centered mind, which is the one that, you know, did all these harmful things. And so then he finished, and, you know, we traveled some more, and then we got to camp that evening. And I was amazed that I was not bummed out. I was still in a very good mood when we camped that evening. And normally, if somebody would have talked to me like that, I just would have been a disaster. You know, I would have been crying or angry or, you know, just kind of, I would have shut down and given him dirty looks and, you know, put ashes in his soup. No, I wouldn't have done that. But, you know, I would have been really moody and complainy and ruined everybody's time, you know. But somehow that evening, my mind was completely okay. And it just really made me stop and think, wow, you know, this meditation works when you do it. So the thing is remembering to do it. Yeah, because usually when we're criticized, we take it personally, don't we? We don't think, oh, they're criticizing my self-centered thought. We think they're criticizing me. Yeah. But they're really criticizing the self-centered thought, isn't it? I mean, not only because our self-centered thought created the karma for us to be criticized, but whenever, you know, if other people are complaining about us for things that we did, it's usually our self-centered mind that made us be that inconsiderate to them in the first place, also in this life. Yeah? So if somebody complains to me, oh, you just come and make the dishes dirty and leave all the dirty dishes in the sink expecting me to wash them. Well, you know what? They're right. They're right. That's my self-centered mind. I think everybody else should be my servant and clean up after me. So even if you don't think in terms of karma, why is this person complaining about me? It's because I was inconsiderate. Why was I inconsiderate? Self-centered mind was running the show. Okay? So if we think like this, then when we live together in community and people give us feedback, we don't get all defensive and we don't get hurt. Okay? Because we're looking and saying, oh, you know, well, I did do what they did, you know. And, you know, maybe they misunderstood it and maybe I wasn't acting with self-centeredness, in which case, okay, I can explain and clear it up later. But maybe, you know, they're not happy with me, and when I look, it's like, I was self-centered, so let's give that suffering to the self-centered mind. I don't need to get all bummed out because somebody's giving me some feedback. Okay? Or we can think, somebody's criticizing me because I've criticized others, and it's always my self-centered mind that's motivated that. So give us the pain to the self-centered mind. So this meditation can be very, very helpful, you know, when we're living and working together. Because then we don't become so prickly and so defensive and stuff like that. Because we say, you're right, you know. I said I'd do that, and I didn't do it because I thought something else was more important, and maybe it wasn't more important, you know? And I was just doing what I felt like doing instead of, you know, whatever it was, however we were thinking. Yeah. So then, you know, then the incident is over right away. Then there's nothing lingering on, you know, between people. And then, in fact, you kind of have to say thank you to the other person. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, we all kind of carry a lot of hurt with us from the past. Maybe something happened, relationships, people said this and that to us or whatever, and we may hold some rancor in our heart. Well, if we do, you know, some meditation repeatedly on this and come to see, you know, wait a minute, whatever I did, yeah, I mean, instead of sitting here and dwelling in how hurt my feelings are, let's look at what my self-centered mind made me do that contributed to this situation occurring. Because lots of times when things go wrong between people, you know, it's not just the one person. It's, you know, we might have done something that people are, you know, are upset about, and we may not have even realized that we did it. We may have been spaced out. We may have just been, you know, operating under the influence of all of our wants and needs and shoulds and ought-tos, which is self-centered mind again. And then we just did something and we're not even realizing the effect it has on somebody, and then somebody says something to us that we don't like, and then we feel hurt for, you know, three countless great eons. You know, rather than go through all of that, sometimes it's just more helpful to look at, well, what was the situation and what was I doing? And you know what? I wasn't paying attention to everybody in that situation. I was operating on my own agenda. I was in my own little world. And no wonder this person is not happy with me. So all that pain, all that criticism goes to the self-centered mind because it's the one who made me do all of this. Okay? So, you know, when we look carefully, we can really see how the self-centered mind makes us quite miserable in this life and how it lies behind the creation of negative karma that makes us have a bad rebirth. We can see how it lies behind us creating karma that also obscures us, because all this negative karma obscures us from understanding the Dharma. So that's also self-centered mind, you know. And then when we look and we say, oh, you know, oh, well, they say that the Buddha was once like me, and now the Buddha's the Buddha, and I'm still like the Buddha. I'm still, you know, cycling in samsara. Well, why? Well, because of my self-centered mind. Okay? So self-centered mind has been keeping me in samsara for a very long time. Now, it's not my friend. And so really seeing the faults of the self-centered mind. And then even on a subtle level, when we do start practicing Dharma and we kind of, you know, we're trying to get over the self-centered mind that lies behind the eight worldly concerns, then we get into the self-centered liberation. You know, I want to do my Dharma practice because I want to get liberated. And why are you making so much noise? You're disturbing my meditation. And then you see it. It's like everybody wants to say, well, where can I go to live where my Dharma practice can be the best? Where will I have the most comfortable situation for doing Dharma practice? And then you go to a community and you think, what can this community give to me instead of what can I give to the community? Yeah. Remember JFK's thing, you know? So this is it. Yeah. And you know, we're all thinking, you know, what's going to be best for my Dharma practice? And I don't want to do this because it interferes with my Dharma practice. Yeah, we can get so self-centered sometimes in the name of creating, you know, meditating on compassion. Yeah, because we're kind of missing the boat somehow. Yeah. So to just be on the lookout for that. And then, even how, you know, if we're very attached to our own liberation, I want to attain liberation. Forget all mother sentient beings, you know. I just want my liberation. Samsara sucks. I want out, you know. And I'm working on getting out, and I'm not thinking about others. That's also self-centered, okay? It's a much more subtle self, kind of self-centeredness. But it's still the same thing of, you know, me, except now, instead of my happiness of this life is the most important thing, or my happiness in samsara is the most important thing, it's now my liberation is the most important thing. You know, it's more important than other beings' liberation. And so it's this self-centered mind that acts in so many ways to prevent us from generating the bodhicitta. And yet the bodhicitta is the source of all benefit and bliss for both ourselves and others. Because if you look, you know, where does all happiness come from? You know, happiness comes from doing constructive actions. How do we learn how to do constructive actions? Yeah? How do we learn how to do constructive actions? Because other people taught us. And specifically because the great religious leaders taught us. Yeah? We're Buddhists, so we say the Buddha taught us. Okay? So we can see that just our ability to abandon the 10 negative actions, it comes from the Buddha, who taught us the faults of the 10 negative actions. Okay? So we can see in so many ways that, you know, and how did the Buddha become the Buddha? Because bodhicitta. Okay? So when we look at all happiness there is in the world, you know, it can be traced back to bodhicitta in one way or another. Yeah? Or if it's easier for you, you can see that all happiness in the world comes back to love and compassion in one way or another. Yeah. And then we see, well, self-centeredness is the opposite, you know, of love and compassion. So let's leave aside the self-centeredness and really focus on developing love and compassion and bodhicitta, because that's going to be good for my happiness now and in the future, and for other beings' happiness now and in the future. Okay. So we have to get over this mind. We have this mind that is a fixed pie mind, okay? That there's a there's a pie, and there's a limited amount of pie. The pie is called happiness, and if you get it, that means I don't have it. Okay? So that way of thinking is, if you get something good, then I don't get it, and I'm going to be miserable. We have to stop that way of thinking because it's not an accurate way of thinking. Yeah. If other people get happiness, that doesn't mean that we're left out of the happiness. Actually, we can still have happiness. We can have happiness at rejoicing for their happiness. We can have happiness because now we live with people who are happy. We can have happiness because now we're free from the guilt and shame that come from being self-centered and cheating other people. You know, and we begin to realize that happiness is not a fixed pie. That there's an unlimited amount of it. And so others can have it, and the more they have it, the more I can have it too. Okay? So there's a lot to think about here. We only did one point in the whole hour. But I think it's an important point, you know? And something really to think about. And remember, as you're thinking about the defects of self-centeredness, don't blame yourself. Don't beat up on yourself. Okay, separate out the self-centered thought and point your finger at it. Okay? Yeah?
How do you do this practice without then starting to see the self-centered thought as inherently existent?
How do you stop doing? How do you start doing this practice without seeing the self-centered thought?
Because I was building up this thing next to me that was getting almost personified.
Okay. So she's saying she's building up this thing next to her that's the self-centered thought, and it's getting personified and seen as an inherently existing. Well, remember that the self-centered thought also depends on causes and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So don't,
so
and it can change, and it can be eliminated. It's not something that has to exist because it's based on misconception. So don't make your self-centered thought into something permanent and too solid there. Because then, you know, you really get quite miserable. Yeah.
Well,
you have to remember that the self-centered thought can be eliminated. And it's based on misconception. Okay. So don't make it into like some other person that you're going to battle for now until eternity.
Instead of battling with myself.
Yeah.
Instead
of battling with yourself, battle with yourself. Yeah. No, don't remember it's not some kind of solid thing there. Yeah.
And arises due to the ignorance that perceives the self as inherently existent.
It's related to that. It doesn't arise specifically to do that, but it's related to that. And if... You know, if you want to read more about the defects of self-centered thought, read The Wheel of Sharp Weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Because it talks all about what we did under the influence of our self-centered thought and the problems we have now because of it. Mm-hmm. Okay, this will be the last question because we're already over time.
Well,
yeah?
Just before you were talking about, for example, it's incorrect to condemn yourself for saying the conventional I want to eat or want
mm-hmm.
to take medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But what about other things, like perhaps there might be an occasion where you feel like it would be very good for me to go take a walk in a beautiful forest or go to the upper meadow and enjoy the vista.
Mm-hmm.
These are sort of different, I feel, than food and medicine.
Okay.
How can we think about those?
Okay, so you say, yeah, wanting food and medicine, we can say that's just the conventional I. But what about when we say I want to go take a walk in the forest? There's, you know, is that different? Could that be self-centered? It's all these things. We can say, I want to take a walk in the forest. Fine. Or we could say, I want to take a walk in the forest. Okay. I want to take a walk in the forest, and I don't care if you need my help. I don't care if you have too much stuff to do. I want to go for a walk in the forest, and bye-bye. That's self-centeredness. Okay? But when you're just saying, okay, I've been working hard, I need a break, let's take a walk in the forest and air my mind out. That's not self-centered. Yeah. And the self-centered, so often, it really neglects others. It's very much involved in neglecting others. Yeah. I don't care what you need, I don't care what's happening with you, I want to do this, I'm doing it. That's the self-centered mind. But just, I want to take a walk. Fine, go take a walk. Okay, so let's dedicate.